Welcome to this episode of Out of the Best Books, the podcast where we deep dive into classic literature and have conversations about what we've learned and discovered along the way. We love all things books and reading, and we want to share our love of the classics with you. We hope to inspire you to read along with us and join in the conversation. I'm Laura.
And I'm Amity. Let's get started. Hey, jumping into the next section of Frankenstein by Mary Shelley. We were just talking before we pushed record how much the book has grown on us in the past little while. The first several chapters, I think, were a little bit more, what do I want to say? A little more difficult.
Yes.
It was kind of hard to get into, but, and I think there's a lot of books that way, especially older books. It's like you have to push through the first several chapters and then you sort of like get in this group. But I really do feel like her writing kind of evolves as the book goes along, and that she's like dropping some of her husband's form of writing, or she's just like really getting comfortable with her style. But anyway, it's really
I think it was more technical, a lot more about the science, where now we're getting the story.
That's really true. That's a good point.
So, yeah. I mean, it's just like, I guess what I'm saying is this week, I'm pleasantly surprised by how good this book is.
Yeah. And kind of devastating.
Yes.
This section is pretty heavy stuff to think about and lots to talk about.
Our other issue is that the writing, I mean, if you think about a book like Frankenstein, it'd be weird to say this, but the writing is so beautiful that it's hard to know. I'm like, as we're highlighting stuff, it's like, what do I highlight and what do I not highlight? Because it's all so beautiful.
It really is. And that's the thing, even though her writing style is like, sort of, like I said, seems to sort of evolve and change a little bit, it almost seems like it does get more beautiful. It's like it's simpler to understand, and yet it's more eloquent at the same time. I don't know if that makes any sense, but
yeah. And it flows, like it just has this. I was telling my mom about it because I'm not usually somebody who notices language. And so I was like, I can't believe this. I mean, every sentence I read, I'm like, oh my gosh, that is beautiful. Yeah, it's simple. You understand it and it's beautiful. So I feel like this is like a hidden gem that I didn't know about.
Yeah, agreed. And probably there's a lot of people who won't read it because they're like, oh, I'm not in for like the gothic stories, the sort of horror stories, monster stories, but don't read it with that sort of an idea going into it. That just read it and then be surprised.
I agree.
Okay, so I've got chapter 5 and chapter 6. And so just to briefly, I think that I will just very briefly summarize, and then we can jump back into like some of the things that you've underlined, that I've underlined, that we want to bring out a little more. So basically what happens in chapter 5 is that this creature that he's been working on and tried to sort of breathe life into an inanimate object, it comes to life. He succeeds. He's been working on it for 2 years and it does. It comes to life. He does talk about how he had tried really hard to make it beautiful, and almost in that effort, it had become more ugly. It said that he had selected his features as beautiful. His yellow skin scarcely covered the work of muscles and arteries beneath. His hair was of a lustrous black and flowing. His teeth of pearly whiteness. Okay, so like individually, those features might be good. I don't know about the yellow skin scarcely covering the work of muscles. But it says that these luxuriances only formed a more horrid contrast with his watery eyes that seemed almost of the same color as the dun white sockets in which they were set, his shriveled complexion and straight black lips. And so almost in trying, he like tried too hard to make it a beautiful creature, and it just became really, really ugly. Anyway, so it comes to life and it's like in his room in his apartment, and he is just absolutely horrified. He can't stand it. In fact, the monster like stands up and holds back the curtain of the bed, I believe, and he opens his mouth. It is a man, and he opens his mouth and there's some weird sounds that come out, and Frankenstein just kind of like freaks out and runs out of the apartment. And I think it's one of those things that you're like, if I just ignore it, it will go away. I think that's really what he thinks. And he's sort of like in this crazy delusion. So he just stays away from his apartment for a long time. He's just sort of pacing back and forth in the courtyard. In that time, he sees this carriage coming towards him and realizes it's his friend, Henry Clerval, from his hometown. He'd been mingling with Frankenstein's family for quite a long time, and he's so happy to see him. Now recall that Henry Clerval was his dear friend, and he had wanted to also come to Ingolstadt to go to school, but he wasn't allowed to. His father hadn't let him, but somehow he had been able to now come, and he was going to be studying languages. He was very interested in that. They're super happy to see each other. The only thing is that Clerval is like, you know, your family really wants to hear from you. They love you so much. They're doing well. They're just worried about you, you know? Frankenstein wants to take Clerval up to his apartment, but he's just really worried that the monster will still be there. So he sort of like goes ahead, finds that the monster's not there. He takes Clerval up, and sort of like in his relief that it's not there, I think that that's the moment that all of his guard goes down and he has this nervous breakdown. And Clerval did observe, he's like, you look really pale. Like, you don't look well. And he wasn't well. He had this sort of horrible nervous breakdown to where he just passed out and he couldn't take care of himself. And Clerval ends up nursing him for months. It's like throughout the entire winter and into the spring. And Clerval nurses him the entire time. Finally, the spring comes. And remember we talked about last time that he was so obsessed with this project that he didn't even notice like the turning of the seasons and the beauties of nature, where he'd really appreciated that before. And then suddenly he like wakes up and the first thing he notices is nature. And so as he comes out of it, this months long illness, you know, he's telling Clerval, you know, I'm so grateful to you. You saved my life. And Clerval's like, well, the only thing that I can ask of you is that you'll write a letter to your family. You know, this is the most important thing to him. And he says, oh, and by the way, I have a letter for you from Elizabeth. And I think there were probably quite a few letters. And so Frankenstein reads this letter and it's just really sweet. Elizabeth is just telling him about their home and how they're all doing. She sort of gives him a little bit of gossip of the town. She tells him about his younger brothers, about Ernest, about William. So Ernest is wanting to be in the military and they're not super happy about that, but they're basically like, well, there's not a lot that we can do once he's become a man and he can make his own choices. But then she tells him about this young girl whose name is Justine. And really we find out that Frankenstein did know her. This is like sort of a method of storytelling that Elizabeth is reminding him. She's like reminding him of this big part of his past. So there was this family, the Moritz family, and Madame Moritz was a widow and she had four children. But for whatever reason, she really favored her other three children and she really just didn't like the oldest daughter, I believe, Justine. I think a lot of it was because it brought her a lot of pain because Justine was like a favorite of her father. Her father had died. And so now the mother was like, she just kind of despised Justine, which is really sad and traumatic. And so Frankenstein's family, his mother in particular, had said, well, hey, why don't you let her come live with us, you know? And so she sort of was taught how to be, like she was in service in a way, but it talks about how it was very different than a lot of service. Like she wasn't despised. She wasn't uneducated. They taught her, she was loved, but that's like how she earned her keep, is that she served in their house. She lived with them for quite some time. Frankenstein's mother loved her and she just like worshiped his mother. But then when his mother died, Justine, she was really, really sad. She did go back to live with her mother because her mother, like all of her other children, died one by one. They all died. And so Justine's mother was like, well, come back and live with me. But she was obviously she's a very traumatized woman, but she would go back and forth from like, oh, Justine, I love you too. Justine, it's all your fault that everybody in her family is dead, which is ridiculous.
I thought it was interesting that the woman, it said the conscience of the woman was troubled. She began to think the deaths of her favorites, because Justine was her least favorite, was a judgment from heaven to chastise her partiality. And so the interesting thing is then she's like, come live with me. And then she dies.
Very sad. And again, it's just sort of a testament to the time, like so many people died, like just all the time. He reads this letter and the story of Justine might seem a little bit random, but it does come into play a little bit later. in the same section that we're going to be covering today. So he finishes the letter, and then he and Henry Clerval, they go around and he introduces him to like his professors, and he finds upon visiting with them, he kind of despises them. He just doesn't like his professors anymore. In a way, he sort of blames them for laying at his feet all these ideas and these things that sort of led him to creating life and creating this monster that's now going to haunt him forever, which it's not really their fault, but that's just where his mind is at. And so it just talks about how he and Henry, they walk all around Ingolstadt. They kind of love it. He's really beginning to heal and feel a lot better.
And I like how this at the end kind of the whole idea of nature, like nature really helps him when he's down. You'll notice he'll be struggling with something or feeling like in despair. And then like, he'll be like, okay, but I looked around in the mountains and the, you know, trees, they helped me feel a little bit better for a bit. And I think that's part of why the language is so beautiful is when she is talking about the landscape and the natural things around them, I think are beautiful. Yeah.
And it makes me go, okay, why is nature so healing? And I feel like that has kind of been a theme of a lot of the books that we've covered, is how very healing nature is in our hard things. Because it says, Clerval called forth the better feelings of my heart. He again taught me to love the aspect of nature and the cheerful faces of children. And maybe so much of it is that, you know, life continues. And as we observe and we watch seasons, we're like, things keep going. There's not this dreadful end that sometimes I think when we're super depressed, we're just like, oh, it's all over. There's nothing good. And when we watch nature, we're like, oh, but actually it keeps going. And there's always things to hope for, whether it's the blooms in spring or the little baby animals that are going to be coming out and running around. Or like he says, the faces of children, which, you know, is indicative of a new generation uprising and good things to come in the future. Hard things, but good things. I just wonder if that's really one of the reasons that nature is so healing, is it just helps us to realize that things keep moving, things keep going.
I think even when you like I haven't always been somebody that loves nature. Like I just would rather be inside. Partly because I'm always cold, maybe. Or I like
that's
to be
fair enough. Or you don't like being wet.
No, I don't like being wet. Enough. I don't like being cold. I don't like being hot. Right. Yeah. I'm like, I like to be perfectly comfortable. But it's amazing as I've gotten a little bit older, like I'm realizing that I do need to be outside. I need that. And when I am outside, it feels so good. Yeah. I just have to wear a sweatshirt or raincoat.
Yeah, find those articles of clothing that will help you feel comfortable.
Yeah, my sister who runs an outdoor preschool always says, like, there's no bad weather, it's just bad equipment.
That is so true. Yeah, it's so true. Although I will say when it's like super hot,
yes,
like it often gets in St. George, you can only take off so much clothing.
Right.
You know? And even then, you're still like, it's just going to be burning up.
That's true. That's true. I always say that too. I'm like, I can always put more clothes on, but it can only take off so much.
Yeah.
And the other thing I loved about this section was like when the monster kind of leaves him and he's so excited that the monster's gone, that he's like jumping up and down crazy and wild and like acting hysterical. His friend is like, what's wrong with you? Like, what's going on? But it just made me like think about, you know, you have a bad dream and you wake up and you're just like, oh, thank heavens, that was just a dream. And
yeah, it's true. It did also make me think, you know, I think exactly what you're referring to is right here. And I meant to share this quote too. It just says, when I became assured that my enemy had indeed fled, I clapped my hands for joy and ran down to Clerval. And it's like, that's an interesting choice of words because this is an enemy that he himself created. So he knows in the back of his mind that it's still there. He can't just pretend like it's gone and be rid of it. So it's again, like one of those things that, you know, something that's very real in our lives. And we're like, well, if I just ignore it, it'll go away. That is unfortunately not how life works. Like we have to face things. We have to deal with things.
Yeah. I like to just ignore things. Like just not talk about it. Then it's not happening.
Yeah. Maybe, maybe it'll just take care of itself.
Yeah. Not usually. And the other thing is he's afraid of the monster himself, but he's also afraid of somebody else finding out that he created it or running into it.
Yeah.
I'm afraid Henry's going to see him.
I realized I didn't talk very much about little William, his other little brother. I think that she does in her letter, Elizabeth does talk about how William is he's just doing so well and he's so sweet. She says, I must also say a few words to you of little darling William. I wish you could see him. He is very tall of his age, with sweet laughing blue eyes, dark eyelashes, and curling hair. When he smiles, two little dimples appear on each cheek, which are rosy with health. He has already had one or two little wives, but Louisa Byron is his favorite, a pretty little girl of 5 years of age, which is so cute. I don't really think about people in the late 18th, early 19th century being like, oh, those two little kids, they like each other. They're so cute, you know? So I don't know exactly how old William is, but he's little. Like, the little girls that like him and that he likes her, five. So he's little.
He's probably like at least eight and younger, maybe.
Yeah, probably.
Presley came home with a little love note. I was like, it was gone this week for a couple of days, and I get this text from my husband with a picture of a love note from this little boy.
Oh.
He said, like, his name, or said to Presley, and it said, I love you. And then it had hearts all over it. And then on the back of it, it had his phone number. And
oh my gosh.
She totally doesn't understand. My husband kept asking her about it, and she's like, he's just a friend. He's like, do you play with him? No, I play with this friend. Okay, well, you know, she's just totally oblivious to the.
Yeah,
it's
totally.
So cute,
as she
though.
Should be, as she should.
She's like, huh? All of her friends are boys, so I don't know if that's why, but she's just like, he's just my friend, not a big deal. Katie asked her last night, this was a few days ago that she got it, and Katie asked her last night, does this boy have a crush on you? And she goes, yeah. And I said, how do you know that? Did dad tell you? And she goes, no, grandma told me, because grandma was with her when she got the note. So she knew, but she's just kind of oblivious.
But like, what does that even mean? And like, who cares at this point?
She doesn't even know. So chapter 7, a letter from Victor's father arrives, and they find out that this sweet little William that you were just talking about had been murdered. They had been all out walking or something, and then they'd gotten separated. And so they'd found him on that route with marks on his neck. And then he had had a miniature of his mother, probably around his neck, and it was missing. So Elizabeth is just inconsolable. She writes this letter to Victor asking him to come home to comfort her, because she's just so distraught by what's happened. Victor tells Clerval the awful news and that he wants to go there immediately. And so they go on a walk out on the university or whatever. They go out to order horses to go home, I guess. And I was confused because it sounded in the book like Clerval, he doesn't go with him. He stays at the university, right?
I think that is true.
Because I was reading like a summary and it said that they went together, and I was like, that's not what that said. But so they're out walking. Clerval is trying to kind of console him. And he says, poor William, he said, I just thought this was interesting. Dear lovely child, he now sleeps with his angel mother, who had seen him bright and joyous in his young beauty, but must weep over his untimely loss. To die so miserably, to feel the murderer's grasp, how much more a murderer that could destroy such radiant innocence. Poor little fellow. One only consolation have we. His friends mourn and weep, but he is at rest. The pang is over. His sufferings are at an end forever. A sod covers his gentle form, and he knows no pain. He can no longer be a subject for pity. We must reserve that for his miserable survivors.
I was thinking, is he really trying to help? Because some of that is like, oh, poor William. Like, that's not helpful, Clerval.
I agree. And something that I thought with that is just like how difficult it is. We never really know the right things to say to comfort people. You know, he's like, he's trying, but it's like, oh, that's.
How awful to be murdered.
Yeah.
Thanks. That was helpful. So he leaves. And at first he's like, he's trying to get there quickly at first. But then as he gets closer, he starts going slower because he's starting to have all these feelings. His emotions are coming up. So he stays for 2 days in, I do not know how to say that, Lausanne. And this is part of the poetry I love. So as he's getting closer, he's noticing the nature around him. I contemplated the lake. The waters were placid. All around was calm, and the snowy mountains, the palaces of nature, were not changed. By degrees, the calm and heavenly scene restored me, and I continued my journey towards Geneva. And then he says, dear mountains, my own beautiful lake, how do you welcome your wanderer? Your summits are clear. The sky and lake are blue and placid. Is this to prognosticate peace or to mock at my unhappiness?
I just think that's so beautiful. Is this helping me, or is this trying to make me feel bad about my situation.
So he's feeling more and more grief and pain as he gets closer to home. And when he gets to the gates of the town, they are locked and he can't sleep. So he decides to go visit the place where William had been murdered. There he sees a big lightning storm and he's so excited. He's excited about the storm and says out loud that
this must be William's funeral.
It's just so majestic and like it's here right where he was murdered and this is for him. And then as he says this, he sees a figure behind him in a clump of trees. And he says, I stood fixed, gazing intently. I could not be mistaken. A flash of lightning illuminated the object and discovered its shape plainly to me. Its gigantic stature and the deformity of its aspect, more hideous than belongs to humanity, instantly informed me that it was the wretch, the filthy demon to whom I had given life. What did he there? Could he be, I shuddered at the conception, the murderer of my brother? No sooner did that idea cross my imagination than I became convinced of its truth. My teeth chattered and I was forced to lean against a tree for support. So at this moment, he's like, I think this is what murdered my little brother. The monster disappears at that moment. And 2 years had passed since that awful night when he had created him and seen him for a little bit and then he had disappeared. So that night he spent he calls so much despair that he doesn't even notice the weather. And then in the morning, he starts going towards his father's house and he's worried about what he's going to tell them. I think he thinks I have to tell them that I had something to do with this and he's not sure how they're going to take it. So then he decides, well, I'm not going to say anything.
That's what I would be like. Who needs to know? This was my fault.
We'll just keep this quiet. So he arrives at the house at 5 a.m., goes into the library to wait for the family to wake up. In the library, there's this picture of his mother. I thought this was weird, too. A picture of his mother kneeling by her father's coffin. Isn't that strange? But, like, his father had this picture made.
I think when her father died.
But it's just an interesting. Like, you would think that it would be, like, a picture of her father and her or something. But a picture of her kneeling by her father's coffin. Maybe that's, like, the gothic.
That's kind of what I was just wondering, too. Yeah.
And then there's also a miniature of William, which upsets him. So, Ernest, his other brother comes in and says that they're all struggling, but especially Elizabeth, because she blames herself for this issue. It's because she had invited Justine back. That's the reason that she blames herself. Ernest also tells him that the murderer has been found. And Victor wonders, how is that possible? Like, I just saw him this morning out, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. So he's like, I wonder how this is possible. I just saw the murderer. And Ernest explains that they think it's this servant that they have, Justine, even though it's hard to believe because she was so wonderful. They had found the miniature of their mother in her pocket. One of the other servants had taken it to the magistrate without consulting them. They were kind of upset by that because they didn't have really any control over her being accused. And the girl at the time was so confused that she is not helping her case at all. And Victor at this time tells him, you guys are all wrong. I know who did this. He just wonders, is anyone going to believe that a monster did this? Was anybody going to believe him? So at that time, Elizabeth comes in and says that she also hopes that Justine is going to be found innocent. They all think or hope that she will be. That's the end of chapter 7. I know, again, we have Roman numerals. I'm like, what's this next one? Just have to think for half a second about what the number is. In chapter 8, it starts with the trial. There are several facts stated that don't look good. But Victor still knows that she's totally innocent. So she'd been out the whole night and she was found not far from where the body was found. Then also, again, when she's asked about it, she's totally confused. Another problem is that when she sees the body, she goes into like violent hysterics. Mm-hmm. So, which I mean, sometimes you're like, is that really evidence?
Well, the thing is, like, what we now know is that there is no one way for people to react when they are grieving. So you literally cannot use the reaction as evidence against them, even though people still try to, but
yeah, everybody can't do that. Reacts to trauma in a different way. So
exactly.
So she's in violent hysterics and then she stays in bed for several days after that because she's so upset. And if we remember, she was really close to him.
She'd known him since he was just a baby.
Yes. So this totally makes sense. So at the trial, Justine speaks for herself and she's hoping that her character is going to help her. And that the night of the murder, she was at her aunt's house. But when,
and then when she got back to the house and heard that the boy was missing, she had gone to help look for him for hours. But then, of course, you know how the gates are locked all the time. So she'd come back to the house and then she'd ended up having to stay in somebody's barn because the gates had been locked. And that night she'd barely slept. And then she gets up in the morning and starts looking again. And because she had barely slept all night when the lady found her, that's why she was confused. And she had no idea how that picture had gotten into her pocket. And then Elizabeth comes and testifies and tells them how much they love her and that they'd known her for a long time and that she had loved William. If she had wanted the necklace, they would have given it to her. And she knew that. So there was no reason for her to take the necklace or to kill somebody to take the necklace. In other words, she had no motive. Victor knows who did it again, but he's wondering if this monster could have set Justine up. He says, could the demon who had, I did not for a minute doubt, murdered my brother, also in his hellish sport have betrayed the innocent to death and ignominy? In the end, Justine is found guilty and the judges say that she had confessed. And so Victor goes home and tells Elizabeth the verdict and about the confession. And it's so funny when they're like, well, she confessed. And, you know, Elizabeth's like, well, then she must have done it. You know, people confess all the time. And
yeah.
Anyways, Elizabeth doesn't understand. And then Justine wants to see Elizabeth. And so Victor and her go to see her. And Justine then tells them that she had lied about committing the murder. Elizabeth pledges to prove her innocence. And Justine says, I'm not afraid to die. And then Victor just feels horrible about this situation. He's hiding in the corner of the cell.
Yeah.
Like in the fetal position. He's like, oh. And that's when Justine notices him. And she says that she just hopes he doesn't think she's guilty. So like, she can't read what's going on with him. But, and then he tells her he's very convinced that she's innocent. And I like this too. This kind of reminded me of like the Savior. Thus, the poor sufferer tried to comfort others and herself. She indeed gained the resignation she desired. She was trying to like comfort them.
She's like, I'm resigned to this. It's going to be fine. I'm just worried about you guys, basically.
Yeah. I just think that's so selfless. Like, I'm just worried about you guys. Don't worry about me. And I mean, in that situation, I would be like inconsolable about my own situation. So they stay with her for several hours. And then Justine seems a little cheerful when they leave. But in the end, the next morning, she dies. The judges wouldn't listen to any of their arguments. They had tried to go in and explain her innocence, but they wouldn't hear of it. And Victor knows that the deaths, these two deaths, his brother and Justine and Elizabeth's pain, is all his fault. When they are trying to get the judges to like reverse their decision, he says, and when I received their cold answers, they told him no, and heard the harsh, unfeeling reasoning of these men, my proposed avowal died away on my lips. Thus I might proclaim myself a madman, but not revoke the sentence passed upon my wretched victim. She perished on the scaffold as a murderess.
Language is just plain yet beautiful.
So that was it.
Yeah. So something that I thought was interesting and kind of important to point out too is, first of all, like you said, innocent people confess to crimes all the time. Even today, it happens. I think a lot of times their interrogations are so intense that they get to a point they're like, I don't even know what is true anymore, which is kind of horrible and a bit of an indictment on the justice system. But also at this point in time, you know, she says that she confessed so that she could receive absolution. So, you know, very deeply religious time, deeply religious people, which is not a bad thing. But there, she already knew that she was going to die, that she was going to be condemned to death. And she felt like the only way for her sins to be forgiven was if she confessed to this thing that she didn't even do. And then like basically her priest would come and give her absolution to be like, hey, well, you're going to die, but then your sins will be forgiven and you can live with God type of thing. And this is something that happened a lot, especially like in the medieval era, people would buy absolution. They would spend lots of money to receive forgiveness of their sins. Of course, they would go sin all day long. And then as long as they could pay for their sins to be forgiven, then it was fine. But in her case, she really was like, I'm going to be condemned to die anyway. I want to at least receive forgiveness for my sins. Not this one because I didn't do it. But if I do confess, then I'll receive absolution. You know, their beliefs are very deep and penetrating. So that was just one thing I wanted to point out. And a big thing with Frankenstein, he was like, I know who the murderer is, but if I say anything, they're just going to think I'm crazy. And it'll just end up like basically hurting my family more because they'll just think I'm insane. They're never going to believe it anyway. Which, does that justify his inaction? I don't think so. But how do you explain what he did?
And it's so hard because it's like he went into this innocently, right? Like not intending to create a monster. How often does that happen too, though, that people go to jail or are punished or whatever for things like their intention wasn't bad?
They
like,
just never could have guessed what the ramifications were of their actions.
Right. Yeah. I'm trying to think of a specific instance, but I think it happens all the time where it's like, yeah, I didn't really think this was that bad. I mean, I think about all the people around Trump, like all these people that are lumped into his indictments, right? How much did they know? You know what I mean? But yet they're going down for it. It's just so interesting. Yeah. I think that happens a lot.
And it's sad just because you're like, that wasn't my intention. I didn't really understand what was going on. But then at the same time, I'm the reason this happened. And
they just, I think they just find themselves in so deep without even realizing it.
Maybe the problem is he's not, that's where his sin is right now, where he's not saying anything.
Oh, yeah, I think so. I think it leads really well into chapters 9 and 10, because this is where his state of mind is pretty dark and awful. He has so much guilt. He's like, Justine is dead and I'm alive. And he says in here, he's like, I'm not the one who physically killed William and Justine, but in effect, I did, because I created this monster who's responsible for it. And kind of like we were just saying, it's like, I'm a good guy. I had begun life with benevolent intentions and thirsted for the moment when I should put them in practice and make myself useful to my fellow beings. Now all was blasted. Instead of that serenity of conscience, which allowed me to look back upon the past with self-satisfaction and from thence to gather promise of new hopes, I was seized by remorse and the sense of guilt, which hurried me away to a hell of intense tortures, such as no language can describe. And I think that that's really true. Like, our mind can be the most torturous hell that we can experience. We can have hell on earth just within our own minds. And he is absolutely racked with that, with guilt. His father sees how much pain he's in. And he's like, look, I loved your brother too. And I'm suffering as well. But he says, is it not a duty to the survivors that we should refrain from augmenting their unhappiness by an appearance of immoderate grief? It is also a duty owed to yourself. For excessive sorrow prevents improvement or enjoyment or even the discharge of daily usefulness, without which no man is fit for society.
I have highlighted both of those.
Yeah.
Which makes me think, like, I'm starting to get this. I'm highlighting stuff that Amity is.
Awesome. But yeah, I just think that's so good. He's like, look, when you are absolutely overtaken with grief, you're ceasing to live. You can't do anything. You can't be useful to yourself or society or anybody. It makes me think about in the scriptures when we're instructed to bridle our passions and to kind of take a middle ground approach in so many things, because it really is true. When you are so passionate, whether passionate with joy or passionate with grief or anything, you end up in this sort of limbo where you actually can't even function. Even if you're like passionately in love with somebody, you don't really function. If you're passionately guilty or passionately full of shame, or you're passionately full of whatever emotion, you cease to function. Uh-huh. At least you cease to function well. And so his dad is like, he says excessive sorrow prevents improvement or enjoyment, but I think excessive any emotion prevents improvement or enjoyment. And so Victor hears this, but he's like, I don't think that applies here, because he just doesn't understand like why I'm feeling this way. So during this time, they actually went to another one of their houses in Bellerive. It's kind of more country, a little more remote. And so he takes the opportunity to really like be out in nature. He goes out on their little boat and just sits for hours and hours. Anyway, he just does lots of reflecting, and he's just really sad. There's lots of reflecting in this chapter. But then he finds himself, says, I suddenly left my home and bending my steps towards the near Alpine valleys, sought in the magnificence, the eternity of such scenes to forget myself on my ephemeral because human sorrows. So again, he's just trying to use nature to heal himself. He just sort of like goes out into the Alps, right? And then he arrives at this little village called Chamonix, and he basically goes to this little inn and he stays there. He sees Mont Blanc and he is able to just rest while he's there. But then he goes out and explores in this valley. And while he's there, oh, I did want to share this one quote, and I just start it because, again, it's just beautiful writing. It says, "The solemn silence of this glorious presence chamber of imperial nature was broken only by the brawling waves or the fall of some vast fragment." Okay, so there's like this river running through there. There's forest. There's mountain. It's just glorious and beautiful. This chapter is kind of funny too, because he's just wandering through nature, just reflecting on things. But I do love that she shares actually part of her husband's poem in here. Yeah, Mary Shelley. She puts in here, "We rest. A dream has power to poison sleep. We rise. One wandering through thought pollutes the day. We feel, conceive, or reason, laugh, or weep, embrace fond woe, or cast our cares away. It is the same. For be it joy or sorrow, the path of its departure still is free. Man's yesterday may never be like his morrow. Naught may endure but mutability." So as he's wandering along, though, he comes to this glacier. So just sort of like this icy mountain. And there he sees the figure of a man who's running towards him at superhuman speed. And he's huge and he knows. It says, "I felt a faintness seize me," because he knows that it is the quote unquote wretch that he had created. It says he felt rage and horror, and he was ready to just fight him and take him down. And he continues to refer to him as a demon. He comes up to him and he's like, "I expected this reception. All men hate the wretched. How then must I be hated who am miserable beyond all living things? Yet you, my creator, detest and spurn me, thy creature, to whom thou art bound by ties only dissoluble by the annihilation of one of us. You purpose to kill me. How dare you sport thus with life? Do your duty towards me, and I will do mine towards you and the rest of mankind. If you will comply with my conditions, I will leave them and you at peace. But if you refuse, I will glut the maw of death until it be satiated with the blood of your remaining friends."
Were you surprised that the monster could speak?
Yes. Okay. And so eloquently. Yeah. So I'm kind of like searching through this. I'm like, okay, was this just like, she's like, all right, I'm just going to make him as eloquent as I am. But he does have a journey and we're going to,
yeah,
we'll see that.
But at first I was like, he can talk and he talks very well.
Yeah. I feel like in any movie where Frankenstein is portrayed, he's sort of just like this dumb idiot. He's just like, buh, 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 you know, which is not the case at all. He's extremely articulate. But this is really important. He's like, look, you created me. If you despise me, everybody's going to despise me. So I need you to just listen to me, to at least hear my story. And then I guess whatever happens, happens. But he's like, if you listen to me and if you do what I ask, you know, I'll go about peacefully. I'll leave you alone. I'll leave everybody alone. But if you don't, then I'm just going to become a killing machine, basically, which, okay, not a good alternative. But he is the monster that Frankenstein created. And now he's out of anybody's control. But Frankenstein is still his creator. He can't just ignore that. And that's really what the monster is telling him. I love this over here. He's like, "I was benevolent. My soul glowed with love and humanity, but I'm alone." And he says, "You, my creator, abhor me. What hope can I gather from your fellow creatures who owe me nothing? They spurn and hate me." He sort of turns to nature. He's like, "Nature is kinder to me than people are." He just says, "I want you to hear my story." So Frankenstein is like, all right, well, I don't think that that can hurt anything. He didn't really want to initially, but then he's like, all right, I'll listen to your story. So they go into this sort of cave, sit down, and Frankenstein's monster begins his story from the beginning.
So it's funny how I keep wanting to call the monster Frankenstein.
I know. Well, we're kind of conditioned to
Yes. It's like, yeah, I just think it's interesting that the monster's kind of saying loneliness made me like this.
Loneliness and rejection, right? We're going to find out that he's just rejected over and over and over again. And he's ugly. He has no control over that. He's scary. He also has no control over that to begin with. But he just keeps getting rejected. He's this very vulnerable, innocent creature who has no idea what's going on. And so what fills him immediately upon his birth? It's just anger and rejection and hate. And so what does he become?
I think of like school shooters or serial. I don't know if the serial killers, but maybe. Like people who commit these horrible crimes over and over and over again, like something made them like that.
Well, and it really makes me think about attachment and how those first several years, well, all the years of a child's growing up are so important, but especially those first several years when attachments are being formed and permanence is established, and whether they are always loved or not, that is so essential and important. And if it's just, if it's not there, then monsters are actually created.
Yeah.
Yeah. Harsh thing to say, but it's also true.
Yeah. I think that usually somewhere back in their history, there's tons of rejection, tons of loneliness and abuse. And it's really sad.
Then they just kind of do it to other people.
It does make you wonder. I mean, Mary Shelley was so young when she wrote this, and yet she had this incredible understanding. And so it makes you wonder if she either felt that herself or if she was just so observant and she just saw it in other people.
Yeah, that's interesting. And it was so long ago. Humanity's the same.
Oh, yeah.
Human nature. I don't know. I mean, this chapter, I had so much written. I mean, so much highlighted just because even the monster just speaks beautifully.
I think 10 would have been a really good stopping point, but that's okay. Just because we're like, okay.
That's kind of what I was thinking too. In fact, we probably still could. We could just be
you
like,
just stop? I think we should.
I think so too, just because it's hard. I mean, this chapter is so good, but it does. It's just the beginning of a story. So it would be really nice to just the next section cover his entire story in one section.
Yeah, that's what I think too. I mean, like when I was trying to divide it up, I was kind of going by pages, like 50-ish.
Sure.
Yeah, I think this would be a good stopping point just because, okay, now next week we're going to get the monster story instead of kind of delving into it a little bit. And then,
yeah.
So there we go. He so is going to go listen to his story.
Yeah, there it is. Oh, man, there really is a lot, even in chapter 10, that we could keep talking about.
Yeah.
But
let's see.
In fact, one thing that he says, he's like, the guilty are allowed by human laws, bloody as they are, to speak in their own defense before they are condemned. You accuse me of murder, Frankenstein, and yet you would, with a satisfied conscience, destroy your own creature. He's like, you call me a murderer, but you're ready to kill me. So hold up, son. You know? Yeah, I think there's just a lot of wisdom there. Yeah, I just keep going back to this idea that he really is like a child. And just because he's a sort of a grown-up looking, ugly child with superhuman strength and size, no one gives him a chance. And so he's just, we're going to find out in his story, like, he's very odd by nature and by birds. And, you know, he's able to learn a lot faster than like a baby would. But he is very much childlike in his awe of everything around him.
Yeah.
And so to me, that makes it even more tragic that he's been so rejected and just destroyed.
I think one of the spots is where he compares himself to Adam, which I think is interesting because Adam was like basically thrown on the earth as an adult, right? But was really like a child. Yeah. And he says, remember that I am thy creature. I ought to be thy Adam. But I am rather the fallen angel whom thou drivest from joy for no misdeed. Everywhere I see bliss from which I alone am irrevocably excluded. I was benevolent and good. Misery made me a fiend. Make me happy and I shall again be virtuous. This is like my child. Make me happy and I'll turn back into the sweet child.
It'll
that
be
I am.
Nice.
Yeah. Just say yes to everything. I'm good. And then he also says, I expected this reception. All men hate the wretched.
Mm-hmm.
How then must I be hated, who am miserable beyond all living things?
And I just think, I put him, you know, myself in his place. Like, do you ever just feel hated? Yeah. We as humans sometimes feel, I know it's probably in our own heads, but it's like.
I'm sure a lot of it is, for sure.
Most of the time.
But I do think rejection is one of the hardest things that we can experience. Seriously. And, there's only so much of that our hearts and our heads can take to be like, oh no, I'm just fine. Everybody's rejecting me, but it's fine. You know, I'll be okay. But no, you won't, because we're social creatures. That's how we are hardwired. We need people. And so to be continually rejected by the thing that we need, you can't really get over that. I kind of like that comparison of what I just read the other day. It's been said about cars and different things, but somebody wrote this thing about water bottles. They're like, a water bottle at Costco is 25 cents, at the concession stand at the football game it's $1, and at Disneyland it's like $7 or something like that. It's like, if you're not feeling valued at all, maybe you just need to change your location. And so I think, you know, and that's kind of what I try to tell my kids. Look, if people are not being kind, a lot of times it is a them problem, and you need to find new friends because you are valuable. You don't deserve to be rejected. There's no reason for that at all. But you have to find your people. Not everybody on this earth is going to appreciate you or understand your value.
I like that analogy. Oh, like just changing location. I
know. That makes me a little bit angry because I'm like, I hate that water bottles are so expensive at like the fair or places like Disneyland. But it's still a good analogy overall. So
yeah. Let's go into what we're reading.
Yeah.
I'm dying to hear from you.
Okay. What did I share last time? The Red Tent? I think I did. Okay, so I've got a couple. I think I'll just share one. Just because I don't think you've read this one, and one that I also just read, you have read before, because I did, I must betray you. But the one that I just finished is called The Sandcastle Girls. It's by Chris Bojalian. It was really good. It was really heavy. It's about the Armenian genocide, which I've known about, of course. Man, it was tough. It was very, very, he was fairly graphic with it because it is something that's really like shoved under the rug just because people are like, well, we need to keep good relations with Turkey. And for a long time, that's what people were saying. It was like 1.5 million Armenians that were just slaughtered in very brutal, awful ways, women and children and men. And, you know, the men would just be marched out and then and shot or tortured and killed. Then the women would be stripped, women and children would be stripped naked and marched through the desert and beheaded and raped and killed, or they'd die of starvation or, you know, from the elements, whatever. And just awful. And so the story follows this young girl from America who gone over there to when America was still neutral, because this is about the time of World War One. So America was still neutral. So she and her father and some other American diplomats and missionaries and things were able to go over and help in any way that they could. And something that I also didn't know that is that a lot of times when people's last name ends with I-A-N, that indicates that they are Armenian. They have Armenian ancestry. And so yeah, I didn't know that. And so like the author himself is Armenian, Chris Bojalian.
I'd heard of him before. And so I just looked it up because I was like, anyways, he wrote Hour of the Witch, which is a newer book that I'd heard of on something and I was interested in.
Yes, I had put that on hold and I'm listening to it right now. I started it last night.
Is it good?
So it's good so far. Yeah, I'm only like a few minutes into it because I started about midnight last night as I was trying to wrap things up for the evening and keep myself awake. But
funny. I was like, I know that name. And that's what I was thinking, that he'd written that book. And so those seem like two totally different subjects.
Oh, extremely. But it sounds like he writes very different things. It's like a lot of history.
Go watch him on Friends in Fiction if you ever get a chance on YouTube. Just look up Friends in Fiction, Chris Bojalian. And he talks about Hour of the Witch. That might be interesting to listen to.
Yeah.
Our friend Nam that was on with us a few weeks ago told me about this book that I just finished called The Rosie Project. And this is really funny because I'd never heard of it. She told me about it. So I listened to the first one. There's three of them. Oh. And I was at a retreat this week for 2 days. And my best friend from high school happened to be at the retreat. And she, which we haven't really, like, we were really good friends in high school and a little bit in college too. And then we just got married.
Sure.
So it was kind of fun to reconnect with her. But like the last day I looked over and I'm like, are you reading The Rosie Project? And she's
my gosh.
Yeah. She was reading the third book. And I was like, so I just finished the first book. But that's so cool. It's about Don, who's a genetics professor, and he's never gotten past the first date. So he just believes like, I am not cut out for romance. This is just not going to be in my life. And he's, you know, probably neurodivergent, right? He's very the way he describes things is really funny and very, you know, I'm married to an engineer and I have a child who is on the spectrum. And so like, it's very much how they talk.
You related to it.
Yes. This is very funny. He's really good friends with this older lady. And she mentions before she dies, like, I think you'd make a really good husband to somebody. And he's like, huh? Okay. So he comes up with this wife project and he like makes up all these questionnaires because he's approaching it just like he does everything else. Right. And he's like, nice. Oh, you're a smoker? Nope. You know, you're not.
Yeah.
you know, or is she on time or late? Nope, you can't, you know, you're not a match. He meets this lady named Rosie who doesn't know who her father is. And so since he's a genetics professor, his wife project, he's already scratched her off the list. You're not going to work for me. The wife project kind of gets set aside while they're working on this father project. And so it's just really cute. So as they're like trying to figure out who her father is and he's helping her, he's also falling for her, even though she's doesn't match his profile.
Yeah. Yeah. That sounds really cute. I love it.
Yeah. And my friend said, oh yeah, it's a weird name, which is why I don't know. I don't know how to say it. I don't know if you'd say Graham Simsion, but it's spelled Graeme.
Oh yeah, so it's Scottish. So it's like Graham.
Graham, there you go. Graham Simsion. The narrator has an accent, probably a Scottish accent. So maybe it's translated. I don't know. It was really cute. I liked it. I don't, like Nan said, she told me, I don't know if I'll read the other ones. And I agree. I don't know if I'll read the other ones, but it was cute. Yeah. So next week, we're going to do Frankenstein chapters 11 through 18.
Okay.
And it should just be better. We're going to get all of the monster story.
All the monster story. And we need a name for the monster, don't we? Because there is a reason he's just been relegated to Frankenstein, because we don't have a name for
Frankie.
Him. Yeah, there you go. There you go.
I swear I've seen a cartoon with a little tiny Frankenstein they named Frankie. I don't know. Frankenstein Jr.
Yeah, I feel like that would work. We're so happy you joined us for this episode. We hope you will join us next week as we discuss Frankenstein by Mary Shelley, chapters 11 through 18. If you have suggestions for books we should read and discuss, please email us at thebestbookspodcast@gmail.com. We would love it if you would leave a review wherever you listen to podcasts and share our podcast with your friends. We want to inspire and encourage as many people as we can to read out of the best books.
As Thoreau says, read the best books first, or you may not have a chance to read them at all. See you next week.